you know, that was an independent film that was made for a price but distributed by Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
You know, I mean I was sent on a road tour. You know, I went to, like, you know, 30 cities and all the openings in Cannes, and there was just a big machine behind it. So now people have to make their own machines.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. My name's Adam Shartoff. Welcome to episode number 213 of FilmWax Radio.
That was Griffin Dunn on my show right then, talking about After Hours.
Did you know that that's the movie he was referring to? That's like one of my two favorite movies back in the 80s. The other one that he made was American Werewolf in London in 1981. After Hours came a few years later in 85. Continued to make films, of course, as an actor, but he also turned his attention to producing and directing. He is definitely a Renaissance filmmaker. It was just my amazing good fortune to get him on FilmWax Radio, and so that's coming up in just a couple of minutes. More recently, Dunn was in Dallas Buyers Club. He had a relatively small part in that, but he was terrific, as he always is in everything he does. He's back again in a leading role with this film called The Discoverers. I just thought I'd check it out. I did. I really enjoyed it. It's directed by a first-time feature director named Justin Schwartz, which is pretty amazing. This was his first film, because it's spectacular looking and really solid film. And it also stars as Griffin's father, character actor Stuart Margolin. And you don't see Margolin very much anymore. He was big time TV actor, I would say, primarily. He's not on the podcast, but I still feel like I should chat about him a little bit. But he was best known for his role in The Rockford Files, I'm going to guess, where he was sort of the sidekick to James Garner's character. Anyway, so. But he's in the movie. The Discoverers is currently playing in New York City right now at the Village East Cinema. I was not able to get this podcast up in time to make it before their big premiere weekend. I apologize to, to everybody on the team of that film, but I just couldn't get it up for the New York audience. But the good news is it's still in the theater, you know, and for all I know, they'll keep it there for an extended run, because I'm sure with all the praise that it's getting, it stands a good chance of that. But if you live in L.A., it's not premiering until May 30th at the Arclight Cinema in Hollywood, and also in Irvine, California, at Edwards West Park Theater. And then it's going to keep going from there, assuming crowds are good, etc. That's called, again, The Discoverers. So it's great to have on Griffin and Justin. Thank you for coming on the show, guys. After that, you know, I'm developing a closer relationship with Kino Lorber. They're a terrific company. They distribute great art films. And one new one is a film called Horses of God, which was brought to my attention by those guys there at Kino Lorber. And I watched it, and it is spectacular, as I say in the interview with its filmmaker, Nabil Ayush. My only disappointment was I didn't get to sit in the film form and watch the movie, because it is really cinematic and just beautiful. As disturbing and dramatic a story it is, it's also just beautiful and wondrous a film. Again, it's called Horses of God. It's currently playing at the Film Forum. It's going to be there at least for one more week, starting tomorrow, Wednesday. It will be there, rather, for the entire coming week. And with any luck, again, if you guys make it out to the theater and support the film, it will be there even longer than that. And Film Forum is real good about holding films if the crowds come out. I guess most independent theaters are, you know, they want crowds. This is worthy of it. Horses of God. Nabil Ayush is in the second segment. And last up in my third and final segment on this episode of FilmWax Radio is the filmmaker Sam Fleischner, who is a Rockaway Beach resident. He made this film called Stand Clear of the Closing Doors, which I'm happy to say is coming out this Friday in New York. And he made this film, which takes place in that neighborhood. And while he was making the film about this young kid who runs away from home, who has autism, and is on the subways for like 10 days, and his family's frantically worried about him and trying to find him. During the course of making this film, based in Rockaway Beach, Superstorm Sandy hits. I mean, they saw it coming, but they had to rejigger the entire story of the film to accommodate Sandy. And so the final scenes take place after Sandy. But anyway, that's just one reason to see it. The other is the really wonderful acting job that everybody in this film does, including this young man who plays Ricky, who's the lead character. It's just a lovely, you know, charming film. It's being distributed by Oscilloscope. We all know they have also terrific taste in films. It's interesting because I can look to companies like Oscilloscope, like Kino Lorber, there's a few others, and know that there's a very, very high likelihood that the film you're going to watch is going to be great. So I tend to feel, and there are other companies like that too, and when I have those folks on, I will mention them too. But thank you for these, both of Kino Lorber for hooking me up with Horses of God, and thank you to Oscilloscope for hooking me up with Stand Clear of the Closing Doors. Let's go on at my first interview with Griffin Dunn and Justin Schwartz.
If history is written by the winners, what happens to the rest of us?
We're spending the week together. It is non-negotiable.
That's it? No enthusiasm?
Dad, you sure we're all related?
You may have noticed your grandfather has a rather unhealthy Lewis and Clark obsession.
Still dressing up, I see.
Now, Lewis, whatever you decide to do with him, I support you.
I can admit him to a facility, but the best thing is for him to be with family, going about his routine.
Every year, your grandfather used to drag us on this thing called a discovery trek.
So wait, what are you asking us?
Oh, who there cometh?
Did we just see some white dude in war paint and leather skivvies?
Who invited these gutter snipes into camp?
Captain, I order you to stand down.
Well, it's Schwartz, Justin Schwartz and Griffin Dunn. The film is called The Discoverers. So why don't you give us a little once-over on the story of the movie.
The film is a dysfunctional family comedy, and it's about a family forced on a Lewis and Clark historical reenactment trek. And it's kind of this Thoreau idea of the family gets lost in the woods and find themselves. So as they journey across America, this sort of broken family comes together along the way.
Right. Well done.
Very well done.
Yeah. You got it down to an escalator, if not an elevator. So I have a question for Griffin. First of all, how did it go at the Museum of the Moving Image the other night? You had a double feature of your own there.
I know. I know. I got so many calls about that.
From people you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so. There were, I would see little blurb things in the paper about it. So, it was a very good turnout. And you know, that theater is beautiful. And the whole museum is incredible. I'm a movie buff.
And that David Schwartz is a really nice guy.
He sure is. I can't get enough of Mr. Schwartz. But it was great. You know, we got the whole tour while the movie was showing, and you just see artifacts and things from some of your favorite movies. You know, to see Paddy Chayefsky's script with his notes and rewrites in pencil in the margins.
Right.
You know, it's my kind of thing.
Get rid of Steiger, whatever it was at that particular. Steiger's too big.
Yeah, bring it down.
I wonder how effective that was. Justin, you were there obviously too, because they showed a nice little preview screening of The Discoverers, which I'm sure audiences ate up. But it was also After Hours, right? Yeah. So what went into setting that up? Were people trying to give you the before and after?
I don't know who thought of the programming, but there was a lot of After Hours fans who were there, right. You know, and so we did the Q&A in the middle, and
is that right?
Yeah. So Mr. Schwartz combined the two movies in the Q&A.
Okay, very good.
But there was like everybody brought a lot of After Hours DVDs and posters and all. It was quite a turnout.
So they showed After Hours second.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it went well. That's great. So how did you two hook up? You know, because it seems to have really taken. Like the response seems to be, this was a great casting choice. And also being marketed as a comeback, which I don't necessarily know if that's the case or not. But if it works, heck.
Well, I think in terms of the comeback thing, I mean, Griffin's already had made himself known as an amazing actor. And so for us, right. It was, you know, we were looking for someone who could really, you know, anchor this movie. You know, it's a family ensemble, but Griffin's really the anchor. It's kind of his middle age, like coming of age crisis, like that he's going through on the course of this journey. You know, he's kind of juggling being a father to his estranged kids and a son to his father. Indeed. There's like this deep rift between. So we were just looking for someone who had that sort of like ability to sort of seamlessly blend comedy and pathos, which is very much the tone of the film. And, you know, and Griffin kind of like embodies that. I mean, and also, he, you know, the character's this like sympathetic, you know, everyman. And so, you know, as soon as people see him on screen, they're rooting for him. And that's kind of what we were looking for. And we weren't looking for someone who could play like, you know, the guy's on troubled times, you know, he's, his career, once promising career, is sort of sagging, and we didn't want someone to play it as like a sad sack. And there are many actors who are amazing actors who could have done that, but Griffin brought like a levity to it, and there's a certain physicality to his performance. It's something that we've talked about before. This kind of, and I think of it like a Buster Keaton like physicality, where it's almost like physical comedy, but it's grounded in a sort of an emotional realism. So I had worked with Woody Allen's casting associate at the time in grad school, and she had cast my shorts. Lois Drapkin was one of our casting directors, but this is Patricia Deserto. And so she had graduated and is now his casting director along with Juliet Taylor. And we, you know, sent it to the agencies, and we got this great response and got these dream lists of names. And, you know, as soon as we saw Griffin, it was like, oh, this would be great, not only because he would be so perfect for the part, but, you know, he's been focusing on producing and directing, and so he wasn't sort of the go-to person that audiences were assuming, you know, would see in this role. So it gave us this, like, fresh, new take on the role. And, you know, and Griffin's, we've been traveling together on the festival circuit before coming right here, and he's been fortunate to win a bunch of awards for his performance, and you know, all the reviews so far are taking note of this, you know, enormous performance. So we're really thrilled with it.
Yeah, yeah. What do you do when you get a script that calls you to be kind of a dad? What do you channel, you know, something that's going to be engaging for people?
Yeah. Well,
escapes cliche.
This script was sort of heaven sent. I mean, it sort of tapped on all the kind of things I felt I had either lived through or was living through. You know, I have a teenage daughter. She was a teen at the time, who's also pretty worldly and kind of a smart ass. And I've had my father is a man who's coming to terms with his relationship with his father. It's a very strong-minded, complicated relationship. And I certainly knew what that was like. And, you know, and I was really kind of touched by where this guy was, you know, I've been in the movie business for over 30 years, and there's ups and downs, and so I could empathize with Lewis, the character I was playing, you know, with this sort of nadir in his life. Mm-hmm. And I found it, you know, very touching and very funny and not self-pitying. I was determined to not play a sad sack, you know, but capture a kind of a guy in transition trying to find the second act in his life. And I found that this was a very poignant portrayal of that.
Yeah. You did keep your integrity through the film, with maybe one exception in the bookstore.
Oh, yeah. No, well, we can't.
But you have to play for comedy.
We can't all be so perfect.
And everybody should have their moments.
Everybody's allowed to totally freak out and smash stuff up. It's got to happen, you know, a few times in your life.
Right, right. But the casting of Stuart Margolin, you don't see him a lot. So there was kind of almost, you're expecting a certain type of performance. You know, the independent film goers are used to a certain type of cranky guy.
Yeah, and Stuart, again, was like, most of the actors came and read for me. And I saw a number of amazing, talented people who, you know, whose work I'd seen in the movies, and was like, felt an honor to have them read for me. But, you know, Stuart came in and read, you know, the scene where he breaks down, and it was just so moving in the room. And, you know, you can feel like when it feels right, you know, for your casting. I mean, it's usually like within the first, like, 30 seconds, you just like can tell that the actor is just, they're going to bring something fresh to the part. Yeah. They're going to, you know, they're going to elevate the material in a way. And you know, Stuart had a really difficult part because, you know, for part of it, it's like his presence, which is what's so large on screen, as opposed to, you know, having like theatrics. And he, you know, just really, you know, gave an amazing performance. And I would say, like, throughout the casting process, it was, you know, things like that. It was finding actors who just felt like they, you know, it was also like building a family. So I later learned that Griffin and Stuart knew each other, and Stuart was actually right? in Days of Heaven, which was one of the aesthetic cues that I talked about with my cinematographer. And, you know, he would come whisper in my ear sometimes, like, that's what Terry would do, talking about Malick and stuff.
Yeah, we figured that part.
And because we had a lot of directors on set as well, like actors who are directors. You know, but I would say the entire cast, I mean, I was just thrilled to work with such an amazing comic talent. I mean, they all have such a different sort of shade of comedy. Like Madeline Martin, who plays Griffin's daughter, is, you know, she has this kind of like caustic, acerbic sarcasm, but it's really this like front for a real vulnerability. And she can sort of just turn on a dime.
Right.
And, you know, and Devin Gray has this kind of like naive innocence, and Dreama Walker has this kind of like earnest deadpan. And then, you know, Becky Baker from Judd Apatow's world, who brought this kind of folksy humor, and David Rashi, who I used to actually watch Sledgehammer when I was a kid, like that TV show. And he's just like an amazing comedian. And Scott Adsit, another Second City alum, and John C. McGinley, this kind of black comedy wizard. I mean, it was like this this amazing ensemble. And I hope I didn't forget anybody. Oh, Cara Bono, of course.
And Ann Dowd.
And I, you know, with all of them, I mean, when you're working on an independent scale, the actors kind of know what they're getting into. You know, you know what your offer is and what you, you know. But it's when people say yes, it's because they're coming for the material. And so we were really fortunate that we got this great camaraderie on set, and everyone, it kind of became this family, and we were all in it together, and all of them, you know, understood the tone and sort of became, you know, created this world. And it was, you know, great to direct, you know, these actors and sort of massage these performances.
It was interesting when I was looking initially at the cast list, and I saw the Dreama Walker and Ann Dowd. They didn't share a scene, as it turns out. But they had co-starred in another film about 2 years ago called Compliant. Yeah, yeah. So it was kind of interesting to see that they had a quote-unquote reunion in this film. But shooting in the woods for the majority of the film, was there anything remotely pleasant about that experience?
I'll take this and I'll hand it over to Griffin. Yeah, I mean, it was a challenge for sure. I mean, bringing like an entire film department and trucks into
extension
the woods.
Extension cords.
Almost everything. But we kind of embraced it. I mean, we were going after this kind, you know, it's a return to the pastoral kind of story. So it's this family that leaves the city, and then when they go into the woods and they're kind of stripped from their urban selves, they're able to see themselves and each other in a new light. So it was really important that nature became a character. And so one of the gifts that you get from shooting in the woods is that if, you know, you bring a film crew in before first light, you like wake up the forest. So we were able to get all of these amazing sort of lyrical, you know, early David Gordon Green, Terrence Malick kind of stuff that we could kind of blend in. So that when the characters are getting seduced by the natural world, like the audience as well could sort of go on that journey. And then, you know, we also incorporated camera work as well to, you know, when we got into the woods, it was, you know, where it had been kind of like static and deadpan in the, you know, in the city portion, it became much more kinetic and lyrical. And so it was almost like the camera was like a discoverer as well. And so, yeah, it's a challenge to put dolly track over like
tree roots and clumps of stuff.
But we had a really amazing crew. We shot the majority in Philadelphia, and an amazing DP in Chris Bovelt, who's gone on to shoot Sofia Coppola's movies and actually a Kelly Reichardt's movie that's Fine coming moves. Out right after us.
Yeah,
could talk
good,
about what it's like to walk and march in the woods with all of those costumes.
Oh, right, because we should remind people that it's a reenactment community that you guys are Stuart Margolin, who plays your dad, Griffin, is very caught up in the reenactment of the Lewis and Clark.
Reenactment, particularly of Lewis
story.
And Clark. Yeah, and it brought me...
As opposed to Civil War.
And it brought his son, me, up as making these death marches through the woods as well. Mm-hmm. And something I deeply resented as a kid. And the kind of funny thing is that we end up
repeating
doing exactly that, you know, and wearing these, buckskins and boots and carrying muskets and, with our 21st century attitudes. And so it was, and there was a lot of hiking. Justin's quite a taskmaster. If he saw, a landscape that he thought would look good with people trudging through it, we'd rush to it and trudge along. Mm-hmm. It was very much about, there's motion throughout the whole, going from point A to B. And so I don't remember hardly any scenes where I actually was sitting.
Mm-hmm.
We were either driving or
hiking. We're
always in motion. Yeah.
Why don't you just go home?
I've been asking myself that one all night long.
So what happened? Why can't you?
I met this girl tonight, okay, in a coffee shop.
I feel like something incredible is really going to happen here.
So when I got home, I gave her a call. On the cab on the way down here, all my money flew out the window. I didn't really get along with her that well.
What's the matter?
I said, I want to see a plaster of Paris bagel and cream cheese paperweight. Now cough it up. So I left.
Kiki!
So I haven't got enough money to get home. Until I meet this bartender who wanted to lend me the money. So I go back to the girl's apartment, but her roommate's really pissed off at me for the way I treated her friend.
This the guy?
Hi. So I march right in there to apologize.
Come on!
But she'd already killed herself. I was too late.
Oh, wow.
Lighten up! What is this?
I'm in big trouble. I mean, big trouble! Now this part, you're going to say...
Let me ask you a question. It's a little off the... The path, but there's been a few articles lately on, and you, Justin, you can certainly contribute here too, but there's been a number of articles and a bit of a debate kind of criticizing the landscape of independent films is very crowded at the moment, and too many films are being made, too many films are looking for distribution or being distributed digital, what have you, because you have a bit of a scope and a context for it. I don't know what your feeling is about it, because you've done a lot of, you sort of had one foot in both spheres,
Is that the problem? Of course I've noticed that there is a glut of movies. Mm-hmm. I think because of the technology, and it's just, they're more mobile. You don't need as many people to shoot a movie. And, that's the good news, is there are a lot of really good movies, but how do you get them seen? The lifespan of a movie is overnight, and so some movies that are perfectly good, I'm so grateful that we have a release, because a lot of movies just enjoy a run in film festivals, and that's the end
of it.
That's
their distribution, in a sense.
Yeah,
right.
That's their distribution, and that's as good as it's ever going to get. I think it's I think the amount of movies that are being made haven't caught up with the options by which to release them. I think it's opening up. And I think people are really starting to figure out how to use all the mediums, from theatrical release to video on demand to just internet to iTunes, all the different things that are making release possible. How you promote those movies is, always going to be a challenge. I don't think the answer is, hey, everybody stop making movies. So, it's really figuring out how to make the technology, adjust to the number of films.
Mm-hmm. How many features have you made now?
This is my first feature.
It's kind of miraculous. Well done. Good job there. But is this something you even, like, is on your radar that you really worry about going into this type of project? Because I personally think if you're putting Spider-Man 2, no, you know, I haven't seen it, so I'm not going to criticize it. But if you put it into, like, how many thousands of theaters, I mean, is the problem too many independent films? If we could have a certain percentage of those theaters for independent films, maybe it wouldn't be such a problem.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm simplifying, obviously.
Of course, but I think what it comes down to is the enormous marketing spends that movies are forced to spend to get out of the crowded marketplace of entertainment options. And it's not even just Spider-Man. I mean, it's everything that you can do now and how our world is becoming. Everything is much more accessible now. And of course, like, it's very empowering as a creator to have, you know, the means of production, the cost go down, so you feel like you can tell these more personal stories and not have to worry about the marketplace so much, which oftentimes is what homogenizes the product that comes out. But I know just, you know, IndieWire, for instance, puts like a top independent grossing films. And I always wish they put like a little footnote next to the numbers, which was the marketing spend that each of these independent films put towards getting their box office gross. Because what happens is, so like Fox Searchlight will put, you know, millions of dollars behind product, and they might break even, and they're kind of positioning themselves for all of these other platforms. But, you know, if you don't have that kind of machine behind you, it's difficult to kind of, get people to take notice. I mean, in the movie business, you know, the independent film business is about like kind of like a slow, you know, build and word of mouth. And especially for our film, I mean, it's more of a, we've been, had a great festival run and played at nearly 2 dozen festivals, and we're doing a lot of these word of mouth screenings, and right. the response has been really great, but it's about, you know, will we be able to get our legs and stay in theaters long enough for audiences to find our movie? But we, you know, we're opening this weekend at the Village East, and we'll be at the Arclight Hollywood, and then we're, you know, sort of marching across the country. But, you know, some of those theaters have like very loyal audiences, so they have been seeing our trailer, and hopefully those folks are going to come see it. But I don't know if the problem is necessarily that there's too many films, you know, because I feel like there's an audience for everything. And, you know, it's just about how we, you know, where you find your place. And a lot of those movies, those tentpole movies that you're talking about, they do kind of blanket the multiplexes. And especially once you leave the urban centers, that's the only option that people can see.
Of course.
So it's great that there are all these new avenues and platforms for people to ultimately see the movie. You know, while we, I think, really like the theatrical experience, and, you know, that's kind of what we shot the movie for, and hope that that's where most people see it. I'm also grateful that people, you know, in smaller towns will be able to watch it on VOD or iTunes or some of these other platforms.
Absolutely. Sure, sure. I mean, and After Hours, which we started the conversation talking about, was considered a very much an independent film during its time, but the whole landscape and the world has changed dramatically, hasn't it?
Yeah, totally different definition of independent, and that, you know, that was an independent film that was made for a price but distributed by Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
You know, I was sent on a road tour. You know, I went to, like, you know, 30 cities, and, you know, all the openings in Cannes, and there was just a big machine behind it. So, you know, now people have to make their own machines.
Yeah. Well, I hope there's a good machine for Discoverers. It opens this Friday, is it? That would be, today's the... So it opens on these. It opens
the
on
the ArcLight Hollywood on the 30th, and then we'll also be in Orange County, and then Seattle, Portland has been booked, and we're in the process of booking, you know, Chicago, Philadelphia, sort of the rest of the country.
And then when does it go on? When does it go on demand and on iTunes? And
we're working that out. Working that out.
Very good.
You know, we're trying to push towards a more, you know, that's a model of the day and date release,
right.
But we ultimately didn't want to. Most of those movies kind of get dumped for a week, and then there's no spend. And we're actually, with our limited resources, trying to promote it so it can have a theatrical life.
No, that's wonderful. Great. And I wish you a tremendous amount of luck with the film and everything else. So thank you very much for giving me your time.
Thanks so much for giving us the opportunity to talk about the film. And hope everybody comes and sees it this Friday at the Village East.
Yes.
We're actually doing Q&As at the Village East. Griffin will be there. That'll be on the Friday and Saturday 7 p.m. shows. Griffin, Madeline Martin, Devin Gray, Stuart Margolin, and Cara Bono, and whoever else is in New York that I may have forgotten. So people should rush to the theater. I think we may have already sold that, or we're about to sell out Friday, so people should hurry and get their tickets.
Go Stand By. Tremendous film. Thank you guys very much. Appreciate it. Again, The Discoverers is currently playing in New York at the Village East Cinema and will be opening in Los Angeles on May 30th. You can go to their website, Discoverers Movie. That's not so easy to say. DiscoverersMovie.com and find out all the details. Okay, so next up again, filmmaker Nabil Ayush and his film, Horses of God.
أحسن جارديان في العالم مع العالم شاف شو الحال
ليش كبرت ولي الحال
طلعت لي الخدمة في الراس
ولو وقعت شي حاجة أنا ما خاصناش بشوف فيها بجوج
ويا شي رخوك جمع بشي تشوفه
كله في شي شكل
Nice to meet you.
Thank you,
Nabil.
Nice meeting you.
I saw Horses of God yesterday. It's so incredibly cinematic that I wish I had the opportunity to see it in the movie theater first time, you know?
And you didn't?
I didn't. I couldn't because we just put this into our conversation, all came together overnight. So my first opportunity had to be unfortunately on a much smaller screen.
So you should come back at Film Forum tonight.
I know I should, right? Well, the idea is that we'll post this next week. Now I'm just going to ask, hold this close like that, and then just hold it. Try not to shake it too much because this mic is not the greatest.
It's always the same when I don't have my whiskey early in the morning.
Oh, very good.
I'm shaking.
Okay, very good. I understand. You get the tremors?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I'll see what I can do. Maybe Eric will put something special in our bottles here. Anyway, but regardless, I did see it, and I understood Jonathan Demme's enthusiasm. So did he see it? What had happened there? How did that develop, that relationship? Did he see it at Cannes, or what happened there?
No, Jonathan saw Horses of God first at Marrakesh Film Festival. Was in last year, and he invited me a few months afterward at the Jacob Burns Film Center, which you probably know is an independent organization based near New York in Pleasantville, to screen my film for an Arab series.
Oh, and very good. And you were there yesterday, right? Were you not?
I was there again yesterday. Well, since then, I became a friend of the Jacob Burns. Very great people. And since that time, I mean, Jonathan never stopped being a supporter of the film. He helped us very much for the Oscar campaign and the Golden Globe campaign, too. And I should say that without Jonathan, we would certainly not be here today.
It's an incredible little bit of serendipity. Do you want to say a little bit about what the story is about? It's based on actual events, of course, that took place in the city of Casablanca.
Yeah, it's based on sadly real events that happened on May 16, 2003 in Morocco. The suicide bombings of Casablanca, and it tells the story of five young boys, the 10 years old at the beginning of the film, who are going to become the suicide bombers of this story, and it tells how those 10 years old boy could have turned into suicide bombers.
That was
the story of their life.
That was my next question, actually, is why you chose to start your story in their childhood, as opposed to, say, while they're initially being inoculated or, you know, they're trained. They're, you know what I mean? Like some other filmmaker might have started the film, or it would have been an alternative to start the story when they are first joining, you know, this brotherhood. But
well, because I was not interested by the violence itself. For me, violence is not a show, as it is screened most of the time in movies that speaks about this topic. For me, violence doesn't come from nowhere. It has a source. So I was more interested by the genesis of this violence, where it comes from where it grows up, for which reasons, than the violence itself.
Where did you grow up?
In the suburb of Paris, in a very violent city called Sarcelles.
It was violent?
It was very violent. It was a kind of ghetto, you know, that you know here mm-hmm. in the suburb of the big cities, too.
So it wasn't one of the fancy arrondissements?
No, absolutely
quite the opposite.
It was not in the center of Paris itself. It right. was in the margin, like City Movement, the shanty town that I'm talking about in the film. And I think it's probably one of the main reasons why I felt so comfortable when I arrived there with those boys, when I did this work on the field, on the ground with them, why I felt this feeling that they have of being abandoned somehow.
Abandoned by the society on a certain level? By the same society that kind of takes care of people who have more money? And
they're abandoned by the state. They're abandoned because the state accepts that some 12-year-old boy don't go to school anymore because there is no infrastructure that are connecting them from the place where they live to the rest of the society, the center of the city. They're abandoned because they have no opportunity of job, employment, social care, mm-hmm. and also because the family structure exploded. There's no more father authority, no more love, and I think that a child that grows up without love doesn't grow up like a child that grew up with love.
Sure, it's almost inevitable. It was almost like fate that the imam would find Yashin.
Yashin is named after a famous Russian goalkeeper, you know, the soccer?
Yes.
Lev Yashin. Mm-hmm. And that's why he shows this picture all the time in the film because
he's got his
idol.
Right. Have I heard of Yashin? No. Not only are most Americans, I'm generalizing, ignorant and about football, you know, what you call football, but I'm especially ignorant about it. I guess I grew up with Pele was the international superstar, and then since then it's kind of dwindled down, I'm sorry to say. But
no, I understand.
Yeah, but it was like I was trying to say earlier, it was almost fate that the imam and Yashin would meet because the imam is looking for, I mean, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, as we say. There are so many of these young, vulnerable men that are growing up with, that don't know love, that don't know what it means to truly belong and have that strong infrastructure and have someone strong at the center of it. There was mental illness in his family, too, right, Yashin's family?
There is his brother, autistic brother that decided to live in its own world. There's the father that is absent, mm-hmm. of course. Yes, there are many like that. And that's why, because there are not millions of suicide bombers in the world, that's why with Jamel Belmahi, the scriptwriter, we decided to build a war story on the relationship between the two brothers. Because for me, that's one of the key aspects of the film. This relationship, that's the reason why Yashin at the end decided to go and kill himself, and that's why the other one follows him, and this competition between the two brothers. And this relationship actually evolves since the very beginning of the film, where there's a kind of admiration from Yashin towards Hamid.
Sure, his older brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So that's where the human aspect comes in, and that's where the film decided to focus. You know?
Yeah. It was definitely a goal of yours to humanize, to give some explanation anyway, to how someone could end up making the decision to take such a drastic action.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, by the end of it, you do understand. And then he loses the woman of his romantic focus as well. And there was, it seemed like almost nothing left to live for. Having said all that, there is a, for the majority of the film, though, there is a playfulness that you have in your style. It's not the film is not a drag. It's such an intense topic. You know, it's such a dramatic and intense topic, but you are still approaching it with a certain amount of playfulness. The kids are truly friends when they're together. They laugh, and there's a camaraderie and a dynamic that's really really lovely.
Well, I'm glad if you both felt that.
Well, it is. You know, these guys have grew up together, and they're still friends into their 20s and 30s. And when you were growing up as outside of Paris, as you said, when did the interest in filmmaking come about? And did you have opportunity to see much outside, maybe of television, I guess?
Yeah, and there was a place in this small city called Sarcelles. There was a place called Le Forum des Arts. It was a place where I could have seen theater, music, concert, films. The first Eisenstein movies, Charlie Chaplin, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And you attended these old classics?
I did.
Wow.
It was a kind of an island, you know.
An oasis.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I would not be here today. I would not be a filmmaker today without this little island in the middle of this big shit, you know.
Yeah, only in Paris would you have, even in you know, a neglected, potentially neglected area, which it sounds like perhaps that you grew up in this very neglected spot. I may be wrong, I don't know, but it only in and around Paris would you still have an arts movie theater. You know, the love of cinema is so powerful in Paris, whereas here you just wouldn't have that.
Yeah, and I think that's a big mistake, you know, because we were talking about the feeling of being abandoned. The best way to reconnect people is of course education, that's for sure, but culture plays a wonderful part. Having the feeling that you're in the same boat with the other citizens, that there are no one speed or a second speed development in your society, is through arts and culture. And when you come to say to those young boys that violence is not and should not be a way of expression, you didn't do the job, because then you have to offer them some other ways of expression. And what could be those ways of expression? Sports, of course. We are seeing in the film how soccer can be one of the possible social ascensions for them. But art, culture is also a very big window to the world, to the big world. Yeah. Because then you can come on a stage and shout your rage, or you can sing or whatever. And that's very important. And most of the countries, they do the same mistake. They park people outside the big cities. They say, yeah, we're going to try to design good buildings and so on, the big architects and so on. But they forgot about the link, the social link.
Yeah, very true. Like I say, especially in the bigger American cities, that's definitely the case. Have you had an opportunity to travel around the states? Obviously, you've been to New York and probably...
I've been, and it's all the same problem. I mean, this is what I call ghettos. Mm-hmm. And this city movement is a ghetto too. You can have different forms of ghetto. You don't need to have a shanty town to call it a ghetto. You can have buildings, and it's still a ghetto. And I still don't understand that, you see. Why? I mean, it's so easy. It doesn't cost so much money. We're talking about social care. It's huge amount of money, and of course it's important. But this...
And they were actually channeling so many of the young people that grew up in them to the prisons, which is an enormous expense and on the state as well. And that could be avoided if people had... Because I think, as you said, that there's an opportunity for connectivity when you have the arts available to you. But also over time, as you immerse yourself in it, as you seem to have had the opportunity by going back and to your church, as you know, that you, with it, just over time, you have this catharsis as you go, you begin to have the opportunity to absorb the art, in this case, film. But it takes sometimes many hours of that to start to get it, you know, it, where you're immersed in it, and then you change as a result. You know, you're it's a thing which is transcendent, just a thing that's obviously played a part in your growth.
In my background and also in my present, because with Mahib Inbin, the script, the author of the book, mm-hmm. because Horses of God is based after a novel called The Stars of City Movement. The Stars of City Movement. City Movement is the area in the shantytown where the suicide bombers left from. And we decided with Mahi, we decided to build a cultural center there. Mm-hmm. Recently, last year, and to bring to those young people some culture and some hearts, and this cultural center opened 1 month ago.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, terrific. That's beautiful. You chose to take this project on, which takes place in Morocco.
Oh, I do live in Casablanca since 15 years.
Oh, you do? Okay, so you were just born and raised in...
I moved to Morocco in 1999.
I see. What was the reason for that?
Well, motivation. Most of my film were shot in Morocco. I'm very excited and intrigued by Moroccan society, probably much more than I am with French society.
Yeah. So you've been there ever since. Did you start a family there? Or?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's nice. Fortunately, as the trajectory has worked out, you have, you're opening the film at the Film Forum in New York City for 2 weeks. That's a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, it is. It is. Minimum 2 weeks. I hope it's going to be more.
Well said. We'll see. We'll try. I'll put the show up sometime before your second week begins. Because I think we're losing the... I can't work quite so fast as to get it up today. But I can get it up in time for that second week, certainly. Hopefully second of several, as you said. I guess people can't expect the cast to be there tonight, unfortunately. That would be kind of a... require probably a larger budget.
Yes, and they traveled a lot with the film.
They did.
They're very happy, and now you know what? They became actors because they
is that right?
They did some other movies after Horses of God.
So they were all of the. What were there like five young?
Yeah.
Are you talking about the? But you're talking about the more mature versions of the actors, not the children, right?
No. I'm talking of the mature. Yeah.
And none of them had acting experience before. Or did it
never?
None
it
of
was
them.
The first appearance on screen.
That is impressive. How did you work with them then?
The boys from the shanty town, you know, they were born there and they grew up there, and some of them still live there today. So, I mean, I knew them just by chance when I was working on the ground about the topic, trying to feed myself what could be the life there, meeting people, listening to them a lot. And then we went into a casting process, and they came up to me, and we worked on the basis of improvisation a lot. We talked about the characters. We didn't rehearse the script itself because I don't like it, usually with unprofessional actors. And they gave me the part of truth. They gave me the part of real life, of real experience of what could be the life in a shanty town. Some of them knew the suicide bombers from far away. So it was really special experience for me, I should say.
Do you have any interest in shooting like something here in the States, or does that interest you?
I could be interested in shooting anywhere. It depends on the script.
It's too abstract a question.
Yeah, I mean, if I received since few months few proposals of scripts, no one really grabbed me until now, I should say.
Well, the movie, once it opens and the reviews come out, and I think they'll probably be pretty positive is my guess. I think people will really, of course, but I think people will be very accepting and encouraging with the film. I'm really grateful for the opportunity of seeing it, and for it to be a story that I'm familiar with from other films I've seen, but have taken no predictable turns at all. Part of the beauty of it was I felt like I had an invested interest in these guys because I saw them grow up in a way, and through the story it was very honest. I wish you very much luck with the film, and I hope in time we get to sit down again and talk again. It was really nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Went to the fortune teller, had my fortune read. I didn't know what to tell her. I had a dizzy feeling in my head. She took a look at my palm. She said, "A son, you feel kind of warm." She looked into a crystal ball. She said, "You're in love." How could that be so? Of all the girls I know, she said, "When the next one arrives, you'll be looking in."
You can go to filmforum.org. And get all the details for all the show times. And by the way, if you go into that website and you listen to this show, you should be getting their emails anyway. You should sign up for their newsletter and just, you know, and then maybe even consider becoming a member of Film Forum, because if you live anywhere close to downtown New York or downtown Manhattan, you a membership is a great idea. I don't get any little extra something for recruiting members, trust me. How many theaters are there like that? There aren't too many. Anyway, just a thought. I don't know. So, and again, they're not my sponsor. So, although, note to self, right? Okay, last up here, Sam Fleischer. Had not met him. I mean, I'm sure that we've been in the same theater or in the same room on many occasions, but this was my first time meeting Sam. He was a really sweet guy. The film is spectacular. It's very small, but, you know, like, acted within an inch of its life. So it's a terrific film. So it opens Friday, May 23rd here in New York at the Cinema Village. I think from there it'll probably, depending on how reviews are and ticket sales, it'll open in more theaters after that. But again, Oscilloscope is the distributor. So between that and my own, I'm hoping between the fact that Oscilloscope is distributing it and my own endorsement that you'll give it a chance. Stand clear of the closing doors. Here's my conversation with its filmmaker, Sam Fleischer. And then I'll be back with the wind down.
He's 13 now. He can walk home by himself.
No, Carla no puede.
Oh, hey, Ricky's mom, right? Did
you see him?
No, not today. I saw him a couple of days ago.
Yes, my son is missing.
Where are you located?
Rockaway Beach.
Anda sin sus medicinas. Se pone mucho peor cuando no las toma.
People are worshiping the devil tonight. That's what Halloween is about.
A-Train, 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 A-Train. Infinity, 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 infinity.
But Meerkat, there's a collective of filmmakers in Brooklyn called the Meerkat Collective.
Oh.
So, and I did have
What's the definition of a meerkat?
A meerkat, it's just a type of feral animal. I don't know what, you know, I can't remember what they look like exactly.
A cat that lives in the woods.
Probably.
But I thought
I don't know if it's even really looks like a cat.
Was
I'm not
once
sure.
Wild and then becomes domesticated.
Oh, well, we can look it up.
Yeah. I feel like people always use the word feral as meaning wild, but
it's actually like kind of an animal that's not wild but has been in the wild,
has been in the wild
and yeah. and needs to kind of be kind of settled down a little bit. It needs to be tamed,
civilized
a bit. Yeah, maybe that's the actual definition of feral.
We should look it up.
Yeah.
All right. Feral. Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
It's one way or the other, or maybe it's was domesticated and then became wild. But I think it's the other way around.
I have some homework to do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm pretty good. Like, I actually spend a fair amount of time looking things up.
So I get word of the day.
Do you? I think I did that at one point. Pre-internet, though, probably.
Yeah, it's good because
somebody actually came over to my house and...
You want
to
know today's? I like it.
Yep.
It's
talking to Sam Fleischner, director of a film called Stand Clear of the Closing Doors.
So the word of the day today is torrentism.
Torrentism.
It's a noun, and it means a mania characterized by an uncontrollable impulse to dance, especially as prevalent in southern Italy from 15th to 17th century, popularly attributed to the bite of a tarantula.
It's all beginning to make sense.
That's so maybe, really cool.
Yeah.
See,
it could have been like
tarantism. That's a really good word.
It is a good word.
For a Friday.
Right. Yes, and it could have started from maybe like somebody having a seizure of some kind, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and then it sort of just evolved into that, you know? I don't know. Who knows? But
yeah.
That it is a good word. And it certainly beats the, what is it, this Friday tweet that goes out that people do, which, you know, which I'm on a few of them, so I'm very grateful for the attention and the love that, but I can never bring myself quite to do one.
Yeah.
You know? How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. So, are you familiar with this podcast at all?
No, but
okay. I don't take that.
I know Rooftop.
Yeah, the Rooftop.
Well, Rooftop. Rooftop is where my first movie I've ever shared in New York was with Rooftop.
Is that right? What was that?
It is a film called Cave Flower, and it's partially... I shot part of it in the Bat Cave, which is on 3rd Street and between the canal and 3rd Avenue, which is across from the old canning factory.
Right, yeah.
Is that American so where Rooftop is?
That's where they're based. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's that big brick building that's an old power station with graffiti on it. Beautiful big building. You know what I'm talking about? It's like it's kind of set in from the corner, but yeah, it's...
Yeah.
You can see it really well from the bridge that goes over the
canal.
Oh,
yes, I do know what you're talking about. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a notorious squat from, like, you know, years ago.
Back,
this
yeah.
is where, like, it was part of the, like, underground network of like, junky punk rockers who would, you know, mm-hmm. go across the country and ride trains. And
oh, so it was part of a network. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, they're not all junkies.
You did a short,
a lot of
or was it a feature?
There. Short.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, Rooftop Films is starting tonight. They're this summer series.
Oh, season. Their party is tonight.
Well, they're showing shorts.
But aren't they? Isn't there like a kickoff party? I got an invitation to.
No.
Like a kickoff event.
This is it. I mean, it's an evening of short films.
Oh, cool.
With a party afterwards.
Cool.
But
where
every,
is it?
But they have a party every night, like after every
right.
evening. I mean, it's just basically standing around drinking free, you know, beer.
Yeah.
Usually, which is nice and fun on a warm summer evening. So.
Yeah. That sounds.
But tonight is the official
May 16th,
first night.
Industry mm-hmm. City.
Yeah,
where's that?
That's in Sunset Park.
Oh, cool!
Look at this. I'm a free commercial for Rooftop Films.
Yeah,
it? Yeah. Rooftop. It's a pretty neat location. They're doing tonight, and then tomorrow they're showing this feature narrative film called The Obvious Child.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, Gillian Robespierre's film. It was kind of a big hit at Sundance, and
okay.
it was at New Directors. And, yeah,
cool.
But we're here to talk about your film, which is called Stand Clear of the Closing Doors, a
correct.
Phrase which is part of the lexicon of New York
City. Yeah.
And maybe other cities, though I don't recall ever hearing that particular phrase. Each probably town has its own, but this is ours, right?
Mm-hmm.
And do you, maybe start off with Sam with giving a little bit of a synopsis. Do you want to do that? Or so people
sure.
who are listening in.
I'm programmed.
I'm sure you have.
With a synopsis.
To, yeah.
So, the most commonly used synopsis that I've probably repeated more times than any other is this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me just get ready for this.
Right. Okay.
So, Stand Clear of the Closing Doors is about a Mexican-American family that lives in Rockaway Beach, and they have an autistic son who is in the 8th grade and runs away on the subway one day. So the film is a parallel story that follows this kid, Ricky, on an odyssey underground and then his family dealing with his absence. And the duration of the story spans 10 days, and the duration of the film spans 96 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to...
He was underground, Ricky's underground for... most of the 10-day period?
Yeah.
A good section of that, right?
All of it.
All of it.
You never
okay,
see him come above ground.
Yeah. No, no. Well, we should say there's like the opening sequence, which where he,
right,
before he runs away. I mean, you know, yeah. And I didn't know if that was part of your 10 days, but okay.
No.
You lose a sense of time, don't you, when he's traveling underground like that?
Yeah.
Was that intentional?
You know, I did make an effort to have time markers just to kind of add to the levity of the situation, but it does become very timeless because so much of the subway is underground and you don't have the sun to tell you.
Right. All those other natural.
Yeah, because I mean, the New York subway runs, it's the only subway system in the world that runs 24 hours a day. And so, yeah, you know.
But though it does run above ground
it's
in many, many neighborhoods,
yeah,
usually poorer neighborhoods. Well, you live in this part of the city too, right? Rockaway Beach.
Yeah.
And we should mention that you shot this, I guess, when Sandy was about now going on 2 years, right? 2 years ago. 2 years ago, yeah.
I shot this. It will be 2 years from Sandy this fall. Is that your question?
Yeah. So you shot it during that period because, right, your film was interrupted and then refigured somewhat by that.
Right. We were in the middle of filming when the storm happened.
And then you incorporated it really well into the story because it adds to this tension, of course, where he's missing and the family, of course, the mother, the sister, there's a dad who is working remotely. He's working from upstate and... you know, they're frantic, or certainly the mother is. And meanwhile, this is all happening on the cusp of Sandy, you know? So he somehow, I shouldn't talk about what happens at that point because that would be kind of a spoiler for you, for your film. But talk about that. So how did you, that must have been, that you, as I read, it took the subways out of that area of
a couple of months
where there was no subway running out there.
It was almost 9 months that the subway was not running to Rockaway.
Right.
My original ending was very much about this train ride across Jamaica Bay, which is quite spectacular, on the A train. But, you know, that just was no longer an option, along with a lot of other shots that I still was planning to get. So I had to really rethink things. And eventually, you know, it took a little time. But I did realize that the storm was a gift to the narrative, my overall narrative. And there were ways to fairly efficiently rewrite the story to incorporate the storm. So
the superstorm, right? But and we should mention that as you say that it was a gift to your story, you gave back in the sense of humanizing the plight of these people, and you really made that part of this New York City a character in the story. You know, but do you feel like that the 9 months of time before subways were running out there were a result of, obviously there was devastation, but was this mostly the result of that devastation or because that part of the city was neglected by the municipality, without getting overtly political about it? But I'm just, since you were in the center of it, that part of the city, I was wondering what your thoughts were.
I saw some images that the MTA had published of the damage, specifically in Broad Channel, which is a little island in Jamaica Bay that has a subway stop and a small community and like a wildlife refuge. It's a really cool island, you know, right there in Jamaica Bay. And the tracks were really just like bent every which way. So it was a pretty major job that they had to do along with, you know, other jobs. So it was just that part of the city just got so slammed that it was like, you know.
Yeah. They must have had shuttle buses though, right? Shuttles, right? I'm assuming.
Yeah, and actually they started a ferry system that's still running.
And
it's great. I mean, for commuters, it's definitely like a more enjoyable way to get to the city and back. It takes about the same amount of time and it's same price and it's beautiful. It's hasn't fully shut things down. And yeah, there is a shuttle bus as well that works quite well.
Lemonade, you know?
Yeah.
The other component of the story that we didn't mention yet is Ricky's autistic. And that's not necessarily, that we know from the beginning. And I'm wondering if that was what was the story initially. Was that your...
Did you know that while going to the movie?
No, I knew nothing, actually, except that Oscilloscope was distributing it,
Cool.
which is usually, I'll automatically watch it. I mean, that's, I can't say that for too many distributors, but I can say it about Oscilloscope. It's just like, oh, yeah, sure, I'm going to watch this. And Charlie, you know, sends me an email, and I'm, oh, yeah, of course I'll watch it. So yeah, I love cool. that I didn't have any yeah. idea about it. I loved it. And yeah. I was like watching it for, you know, whatever, 80, 90 minutes. It was great.
Yeah.
It was 110 minutes, so therefore I turned it off. No, I'm kidding.
I don't 96
minutes.
96 minutes. Yeah, I was going to say, what, you didn't watch the ending?
Those last 6 minutes of fat.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the autism, you want to talk about, you know, this is, a major health issue in this, or at least it's a major conversation. Or
yeah, it's a hot button.
It's a hot button.
Hot button topic.
It truly is.
Say. And as it should be, I mean, I think it's an important conversation for people to be having because it's becoming more and more prevalent, this condition. And I've always been interested in it. I've never known anyone too closely, but I've had meaningful and lasting encounters with people on the spectrum since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And it's something I've always been very interested in. And yeah, and then this movie, got the idea to make this movie and thought it was a nice way to kind of like learn more about what autism is and the way that our culture reacts to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really important because a lot of kids on the spectrum have a very unique perspective on the world. And I think there's something to learn from that. And I think it would be great if we could stop calling it a disorder and try to support these kids in their unique talents rather than try to convert them into normalcy or like try to force them into, you know, systems that are very rigid for not just kids on the spectrum, but a lot of anyone with like a different style of learning or communicating, you know,
right.
our schools are pretty traditional,
right.
Or they've been the same way for a really long time now. They haven't really like, I mean, of course there's exceptions and there's a lot of schools doing really progressive following new models and figuring out how to accommodate all these different kinds of kids. But,
and it's all an uphill battle to some degree because, of course, the way we deal with these things is to continue to jerry rig or whatever the correct term is, the issue into our current conventions. So, you know, rather than reinvent, as you're suggesting, so we like, sort of what we call normal or standard ways of dealing with things, and if somebody's outside of that, then
people get threatened by it.
Yeah,
everyone. I mean, our culture has like a lot of this fear of like things that are different. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, it's like ties into the like. I mean, no. I was just gonna say like the fact that gay marriage is still not legal everywhere to me only represents a fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that people can't deal with like things that are different than what they know, because then it makes them question themselves, and they're not. A lot of people don't question, you know, the way things are,
right?
And
right.
that's so. Anyways, I think that's all connected to autism. And
the scariest thing of all is there may not be a status quo.
Yeah,
we just might have to give up on this concept of the status quo. You know, and then that everything outside of that is an exception. Well, maybe we're living in a world of exceptions.
Yeah,
you know.
But that's, I wish that it wasn't called autism spectrum disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish it was just called autism spectrum or like autism spectrum, you know, special abilities, you know, like, I don't know. Like,
our language is tricky.
It is. But the thing is, like, a disability is a really negative term. And for a young human being, being brought to specialist after specialist, and being told you have a disability, all that does is shatter your confidence. And like the thing that I think young people in our world need more than anything,
you're
is
working
just,
from a deficit.
What?
Then you're working from a deficit automatically by default, right?
So, right.
Yeah, and also we keep trying to find the right word for it, how to best make it seem the least destructive a word. And meanwhile, it's just like, it's letting go of the concept altogether. Maybe it was the right way to kind of approach it, you know? In fact, there was another thing just came to mind when you were, how you describe this is when this filmmaker died a couple of days ago, Malik Bendjelloul, the filmmaker who made Searching for Sugar Man. And, you know, all the headlines were saying the next day, Malik Bendjelloul commits suicide. And somebody wrote to me you know, that they feel like committing is something you do with, you know, a crime. You commit a crime, you commit, you know, violence, you commit the, and so, you know, and it just so happened I worded it that
committing suicide is a crime. It's illegal.
It is illegal in many places. Yeah, right. So therefore, maybe it isn't inappropriate until we change the laws. But I mean, what the way I had described it in was that he was suffered from depression. You know, I said it's another, this illness claimed another life, and it's, you know, tragic in that sense. But it's interesting how, again, we're always figuring it out. Mm-hmm. You know, we're always sort of way behind. It's like at least the status quo is, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is a terrific film, and it's called Stand Clear of the Closing Doors. All the actors, how did you find these folks? I'm going to guess, and I could be wrong, but it seems as though they were non-professional actors.
It's a mix. Okay. So the mom, Andrea Suarez Paz, mm-hmm. I met on the street. I had a premonition about uh-huh. meeting this the person who was going to play Mariana, and I knew. I told myself one day that like I needed to just be extra aware because this person is around me. And then within 3 days of having this thought, mm-hmm. I literally see Andrea on the street with her son. And I was like, holy shit, that's her. So I went up and started talking to her.
What was her reaction to your just approaching her?
Oh, I think she was a little bit like,
who is this
weirded
guy?
Out.
Yeah,
probably. But the crazy thing is that she actually came to New York from Mexico 8 years ago to go to theater school and to be an actress. And she's done a number of plays and short films, and she had never done a feature. Yeah. And had just about given up on the idea of acting at this point because she had a son and was like, you know,
yeah.
hadn't done it in a while. Uh-huh. And then I, you know,
you cursed her.
I walked with her for a little while, told her a little bit about what I was doing, mm-hmm. sent her the script. And then she came in and auditioned, and it was just like, okay, you're the person.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've reinvigorated her drive to be an actor again, which could be, of course, yeah, a blessing or a curse, depending on
how you
She's
an incredible actress, and I think a lot her performance is so real that most people think that this is just who this person is, that she's not an actor, which is unfortunate for her because she's actually – it's a testament to her acting chops. But,
right, of course.
But I think a lot of people don't quite realize that this is nothing like who she is. She could play – when I met her, she had zero accent.
Right.
I mean, she can play straight – she can play anything.
Yeah.
She can play a girl who grew up in New York. And I hope she gets opportunities to do that and doesn't get just like, you know, pushed into the Latina category.
Right. Oh, yeah, of
only,
course.
You know.
Sure, of course. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you, in the sphere of independent film, we just if we don't recognize somebody, we just assume they're a non-professional actor. You know, if it's a studio-made film, we don't go through that. We just know that they're actors, you know. And then also it's the same thing with dialogue. It's like, how much of this dialogue, I'm sure you get this all the time, was improvised? You know, no, there was a script. It's just that, again, it's for some reason, because it's an independent film, most people, and I obviously fall victim to this too, will think your actors are non-professional actors and your script is largely improvised and all that. It's usually not the case. Usually the case is...
I did improvise a lot mm-hmm. in this film, though.
Mm-hmm. Did you want them to feel kind of just comfortable in their own words?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just say it the way you would say it.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But there was a script.
Yeah, we definitely had a script.
Though. Okay.
I mean, a two-year-long like
process.
Document that was constantly being like
sculpted,
ringed, and
yeah.
turned, and
sure,
yeah. But
without the Sandy story,
yeah, exactly. And then you know, finding Jesus, it was really important to me to work with a kid who is on the spectrum because I didn't feel like I was in a position to tell.
Mm-hmm.
someone how to behave like they have autism, and I thought that would ring false. So we did a search on, like, one of the casting directors, Eleanor Hendricks, did a search on...
Oh, yeah, Ellen, she's been on this podcast.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you know, she's a filmmaker and an actor.
Yeah, yeah. And she used to live around the corner from here, like, actually on this block.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for years. But Eleanor posted on autism blogs, and Jesus's mom found the post and, you know, put Jesus up for this. Jesus was, you know, in Florida. His mom responded to this post, and they did a really nice audition tape. And then I went down to mm-hmm. South Carolina for a wedding, and they drove up from Florida and met mm-hmm. me there. And we made a short film at an aquarium in a day.
Oh, yeah?
Just Jesus and I, we, like,
walked around. We did a number
as an
of
experiment
different.
In a way.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So I just wanted to know what it was like to photograph him.
Yeah, that's great.
So I wanted to know what his voice was like. So mm-hmm. I had him read things that I wrote, and then I asked him questions and had him riff on different ideas and things that are going on in his life. And mm-hmm. and so, yeah, we made a little film together, which was helpful for, you know, to know what it was like to work with him, and then also to just show people, some of the investors and, you know, people back here,
of course, right.
what this kid was like. And
what he was
that just premiered on Dazed Digital, if you want to look at it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's a Dazed Digital, so people can find, we'll put the link for that also
yeah.
on the notes.
It's a cool little short. I'm glad it's like out there now. It actually played at La Dida Film Festival too.
Oh, okay, yes, of course. Oh, that's Miriam.
The first
Bell's.
Year that yeah that what Miriam did that.
Oh, I may have seen it then. It was the first year because I probably saw all the shorts
at 92Y.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tribeca. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was saw probably all the shorts. Maybe I saw it.
It played with. Yeah, Black Balloon. And,
yeah, I remember.
And then,
I remember. And there was the Koichi-san. And yeah,
and that movie that Chris Maggio and John Wilson and Chris Maggio's short is mm-hmm. like a masterpiece. I mean, I can't believe how good that short film is. It was in that same program.
Is that the one where they're walking around like outside at the?
They're kind of doing like a talk show production.
Yes, I saw that. Yes,
it's
yeah.
really crazy.
Yeah,
I've never seen a movie quite like
no,
this.
No, no, no. It's really, really. It's kind of absurdist. It's kind of
totally absurdist.
Experimental but on some level. Yeah,
like nailed.
Yeah, yeah. And I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, you saw Circles.
Yeah. No, I saw all the shorts because I got like links to everything because I had Miriam on and Dustin DeFay and. And Alex Karpovsky. You know, we just did like a la-di-da segment.
Cool. Well, I'm glad it was so memorable.
Well, it all comes back. Once I see it, I'll remember it.
Yeah.
If I were to look at it again, because of the synapse, I see a few things here and there. So it all starts to blur. But I saw that your film a couple weeks. I mean, I wouldn't have to refresh because it's very, very, at least for the moment, it's very clear in my mind. Where is it? So it's premiering a week from Friday?
Yeah, a week from today.
A week from today. So that would be the 23rd.
23rd.
Okay. Stand Clear of the Closing Doors is premiering Friday, May 23rd here in New York.
Hopefully. Okay. You know, if we have a good opening weekend,
right.
the 23rd, then it'll probably go to L.A. and maybe some other cities. So
right. I'm sure it will.
Hopefully people can come out.
Yeah. And then I'm sure, you know, because it's Oscilloscope, you'll have other options for seeing it as well.
Yeah, we'll see.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Thanks for taking the time.
Oh yeah, yeah.
To chat,
and come back again, and we'll talk about other things.
Vive Rooftop.
There you go. Well, we're in the midst of lots of film stuff going on in New York. Here's just a few things that are going on right now or coming up. Well, first up, let's just fill you in on things about Rooftop Films, since they present my podcast and they're friends of ours. I guess their opening weekend went really well. I did stop by on a Saturday. Let me just tell you, it was my intention to be there all opening weekend. However, what happens is I have a young boy, and I needed to hang out with him. And so that is what I had to do. But I did stop by real briefly for Obvious Child on Saturday and checked out their venue where they were doing the screening at Industry City. I wanted to check that out. First of all, coming up this week on Wednesday, it's sold out. So if you do not have tickets, I apologize. But they're playing Cold in July. I love that movie. It's directed by Jim Mickle, who last year he had a film called We Are... What We Are, which I had him on the podcast with that. He's back with Cold in July, which stars, you know, Michael Hall, who was Dexter, and it also stars Don Johnson. It is such a good movie, taut thriller. This one is terrific, much really, really entertaining, good time. If you don't have tickets, it'll be out theatrically shortly. Another thing they're doing on Thursday of this week, they're doing a screening at the Trilock Fusion Center, which is in Clinton Hill. It's all the way north, practically by the Brooklyn Naval Yards, but it's on Waverly Avenue in Clinton Hill, and they're going to be showing We Are the Best. On Friday, May 23rd, is The Infinite Man, shown at the Old American Can Factory. That's on Friday, May 23rd, all coming up at Rooftop Films. The Northside Film Festival is coming up in June. In fact, it's coming up on June the 16th, which is a Monday, right through the 19th in Williamsburg. There's a number of venues, including Nighthawk and the Wythe Hotel and Indie Screen, where they're going to be showing films. The film festival looks great. I just sat down with Sarah Lerner, who is on the crew and the programming crew there. And yesterday, in fact, because I'm going to be doing a live podcast on Monday night, the 16th, at Nighthawk. And I just found out who those folks that I'm going to be having on the panel are, but I'm not going to announce it until I've confirmed it. So probably on the next podcast, I will announce who the folks are that I will have on that live podcast at the Nighthawk. So put that on your radar right now. If you want to see Filmwax Radio Live, we had an event last month, which turned out really well. And so I'm excited to be doing my second live podcast in June on the 16th with the Northside Festival. Their website is northsidefestival.com. The schedule is already up. Tickets, I believe, are available. They've got, I'm looking at their list of films right now, and there's a bunch here that look great, including Fort Tilden, which was a hit at South by Southwest. The Babadook was, I believe, a Sundance hit. It was also at New Directors. I saw that. Homemakers is supposed to be terrific. Summer Blood, my friend Owner's film, is going to be playing there. Bunch of others. Please forgive me if I didn't mention. Oh, my friend Jason De Silva, who was on this podcast, will be screening his documentary When I Walk, which I recommend as well. So there's all sorts of, and many, many short films and a lot of events, including my live podcast, all at the Northside Film Festival, June 16th through the 19th. Last up, Banff Cinema Fest is all been announced, and the schedule is up. Tickets are available. It is an amazing lineup, which will include, well, first of all, Banff Cinema Fest will take place between June 18th and 29th. Right there, I've already presented you with a conflict of scheduling of interest, potentially, by talking about two different festivals that are overlapping, but I can't help it. I want to just tell you, I'm looking out for your best interest, so I want to let you know that if you decide to go to Banff Cinema Fest, opening night film at Banff Cinema Fest this year is Richard Linklater's Boyhood. And it's sold out, but I don't know. Maybe you can go stand by. Don't worry. You'll have other opportunities to see this spectacular movie. It's called Boyhood. It's a film that he's been working on for, I forget, like 12 years or something like that. Banff Cinema Fest is in its sixth season. I've been with it since the beginning, going, seeing great independent films, the best from Sundance and South By and a few other festivals. But and they do a lot of great New York premieres. This year, they're also doing, on the closing night of the festival, they are presenting the 25th anniversary screening of Do the Right Thing. Spike Lee is going to be there. So the whole thing sounds pretty exciting. And I'm going to have on a few of the programmers from Banff Cinema Fest on in a couple of weeks. So you'll want to tune into that, including my friend Ryan Werner, who I haven't not, oddly enough, had on this program before. So keep tuning in, folks. The best way to tune in, of course, is if you are subscribed to Filmwax Radio. And the obviously way to do that is just to go to iTunes and take care of that immediately. If you're there subscribing, give me a star rating. And if you have a minute, just write in a little comment about what you think about the show. And, of course, share my show. Please, please recommend it to your friends or anybody you know who likes independent film. And you know how to reach me. You can email me directly at adam@filmwax.com. You can reach me at on Twitter with at Filmwax Radio or on Facebook at facebook.com/filmwaxradio. I appreciate it. And I'm going to let you go now. If you've stuck with me this far, it means much. It means a lot to me. We'll be back next week. On the next episode, I have to talk about that for just a second, but just to let you know who's coming up on the next episode of Filmwax Radio, episode number 214, and that would be Kelly Reichardt, who talk about just somebody I've wanted on the show for a long time, and Peter Sarsgaard, who is one of the stars of her latest film. It's called Night Moves. It's like her fourth or fifth feature film. And then we're going to also have Joe Swanberg back on for his whatever third visit. to talk about all of his films that were put on Fandor. And then we also have on coming up is Livia DePaulis and Danelle Aliav with their film Modicon, which is opening on the 30th of May, and Meg Griffiths and Emily Wachtel, who are the creative team behind Meg's new film, which is called Lucky Them. It's a comedy. It's a romantic comedy, and it is going to be opening May 30th as well here in New York, and we have all those people coming onto the show. So thank you for listening. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Till next time, take it easy.
This is David Gorgony, the director of The Golden Girls and Mama's Family, and my new movie, Joe. Actually, the Golden Girls, Rue McClanahan's character was originally going to be played by Nicolas Cage. And then, what's her name? Estelle Getty wasn't, their chemistry was off. And so then he was going to play Estelle Getty's part. And then Betty White got pissed off so it was like a very complicated situation. So Cage had to wait until 2013 he didn't get that passion project role that he'd wanted in The Golden Girls. So now he played Joe. And he's very satisfied with it.
And you're listening to Film Wax.
And you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
I never understood before. I never knew what love was for. My heart was broke, my head was sore. What a feeling. Tied up in ancient history. I didn't believe in destiny. I look up, you're standing next to me. What a feeling. What a feeling. Couldn't take the hurt again. What a feeling.